Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And today, my guest, I'm delighted to have on Jim Nerikas. Jim is a prominent member of the organization called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, otherwise known as FAIR. FAIR is the Media Watch Group, providing vital media bias and censorship critiques since 1986, 23 years or so. Since 1990, Jim has also been the editor of FAIR's bi-monthly publication, Extra, and he currently co-manages the website, FAIR's website. Extra's July issue is a special. It's a special that features the future of journalism. Well, we can only hope that the future is better than the present. The present is certainly worse than the past. The past was never that good, but it was better than what we have now. And as I look at the cover on an email that Jim sent me, it shows, I have a small graphic. It looks like a robotic figure heading upward, so I hope the symbolism means a better future than the present. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm delighted to have you on. I'm certainly a fan of FAIR, and anything that promotes good journalism is something that's very vital, because the dominant form, as we both know, certainly does not do the job, and it's organizations like FAIR. It's the alternative media that really provides the most important sources of good information. But talk about your issue. It's a vital topic, and it's something we need to spend a lot of time on.
Well, it is, as you say, looking at the future of journalism. A big part of that, you know, if you want to know where you're going, you need to take a look back at where you've been. In the piece that I wrote for the issue, I look a little bit at the state of journalism, past and present, and point out that it does leave a great deal to be desired. When people are talking about the economic crisis in journalism and worrying that the current situation, the current structures of journalism don't seem to be sustaining themselves, that has some positive aspects for us, that we for a long time felt like new structures were needed to have a truly democratic journalism, and it seems like this crisis is a good time to talk about what kind of journalism we really want to have, what kind we need.
And the crises you're talking about, of course, the economic calamity that we're going through, that I honestly believe is nowhere near the end, and I suspect the worst is still to come. But newspapers especially are being very hard hit. I live in Chicago. When the Chicago Tribune goes bankrupt, I'm sure Colonel McCormick turned over in his grave when that happened, but it's still publishing. It doesn't produce too much, but it publishes, and the New York Times is in trouble, and it's satellite. I'm an old Bostonian, the Boston Globe. That paper is in trouble, so they downsize. They lay off the professional staff that may be too expensive, and they just produce more of what we need so much.
Right.
Before you start, that music means a commercial break. We'll have one more before the bottom of the hour. I know you're going to spend 30 minutes with me. You're welcome to spend as much time as you want. But let's take that break, and we'll come back, and you can pick up.
Great.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Jim Nerikas of FAIR. Jim, you know Bob McChesney well, and he's one of my heroes. He's been on the program a couple of times, and when his new book comes out in the fall, I think hopefully I'll get him back and we'll talk about it. I've reviewed two of his books. One was a couple of years ago. He wrote Communication Revolution. He mentioned an important theme of the book. He talked about we're at a critical juncture, the term that he used. And he, I think, referred to a window that could last a decade or more, a great opportunity to do things because of the digital revolution that were impossible to do in years past. And then last March, he and John Nichols wrote a Nation magazine article on the death and life of great American newspapers, and he referred to it as a crisis of journalism, a crisis of democracy, and that journalism is collapsing. Well, Jim, is journalism collapsing, or do we see what's going on now as an opportunity for a better future?
Well, I think that the crisis in journalism going on now is there's a few things that are you know real trends and some things here that are maybe there's not so much that as meets the eye. The one thing that you have to understand is that newspapers traditionally have had local monopolies and therefore have had been able to reap monopoly profits. They've been the only game in town for a lot of advertisers, and so they can sort of charge what they want. And for readers as well who didn't have access to easy sources of news outside their immediate area. And that's not true anymore. There's both more means of advertising and there's more ways of getting information now. And so the profit levels are not going to be the same that they used to be. And part of what is seen as a crisis is the reluctance of the media industry to accept that they're not going to have, 20% profit rates or whatever they were counting on getting. And they've also have made some very bad deals. You know, you alluded to the Boston Globe, the Chicago Tribune is in trouble. A lot of these papers are in trouble because of either the company that owns the paper has made expansion plans that are not really justified by the economics, or the company's been taken over with leveraged buyouts that result in heavy, heavy levels of debt. In the case of the Tribune, it's both. The company expanded a great deal and then was taken over by a real estate tycoon. And these moves sort of coinciding with the housing bubble really have left the newspaper industry in a bad situation. But it's more kind of a temporary crisis for these companies and not something long-term affecting the future of journalism. What does affect the future of journalism, though, is the long-term migration of readership away from print and towards the Internet. And this is not, in terms of informing the public, I think this is really a good thing. That's a big part of the demonopolization that I was referring to earlier. It happens because of the people can get papers over the Internet from the next town, the next state, or from another continent. And that's obviously a good thing in terms of people informing themselves. But it is much harder to get people to pay for information that they get over the Internet because there is so much competition. There's so much free stuff out there that it's hard for people to ask for money for their information.
Jim, how does that affect Extra? Of course, Extra circulation doesn't begin to compare with Time Magazine, but Extra produces some important material. You're critiquing the media, something that so badly needs to be done. You're the antidote. You report on what they say, and you explain how they misreport to the people who read them so that their readers really know nothing.
It is a problem for Extra. More people are reading our stuff on the Internet than are reading it in print now.
You give them some. It's really an appetizer to get them to subscribe.
Yeah. All the back issues we have been slowly putting up on the web. We usually put two or three articles from the new issue up as soon as it comes out.
Me, that's a godsend, because I like to quote you every now and then in my own writing, which I've only been doing for about 4 years in my retirement, Jim. I range over an awful lot of topics, but I do some media critiques. I'm not an old pro like you guys are, but I do some media critiques, and I love to quote Thea. So to go into an old issue, that the only way I could get it would be to get it online, maybe 3-5 years ago, whatever. It really is terrific to be able to access something and quote you guys in what I'm saying. And you're so authoritative that it's vital for me to be able to do it.
And that is our chief goal, is to get the information out, which is why we do try to put up as much as we can. But as with other publications, we are facing the issue of how do you keep the lights on when people increasingly reading over the web rather than in print. And, you know, you can ask people who are reading online to make contributions. And I think that over time, people do have to realize that there isn't a free lunch, that you have to, that information does need to get paid for. Just as you leave a tip when you eat at the restaurant, you need to leave a tip for the people who are providing you with the news and information that you need.
I think another example is I've lived in Chicago for 40 years. I'm not a native, but I've been here for 40 years. And for many years, it's been a long time since I've subscribed to the Tribune. But for many years, I think I read it, subscribed to it by rote. I lived in Chicago. When I came, we had three dailies. We have two now, which is unusual because most cities have only one. We have two. Well, Chicago is a big city. But I read it by rote until one day it was like eating the same thing over and over again. And one day you take a bite and it just doesn't taste good to you. It finally dawned on me that, my goodness, you know, they're really not, you know, you can get the sports scores, you can get this, you can get that. But there really isn't an awful lot in this paper that really is telling me very much. And I finally decided, well, I'm spending my money. I'm not getting much for it. So I stopped. And it's been many years. And, of course, you can get a lot of the material online, which is true of any paper. But the Tribune is suffering. The New York Times is suffering. The possibility that the New York Times would stop printing a daily almost seems inconceivable, but I guess it can happen.
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of important information that comes out of the daily corporate press. This is the main way that we have informed ourselves about the ongoing activities of our government and of the business in this country. But it has done so really in such a compromised way that its usefulness to the public has really not been what it could have been. When you look back at the major events of the modern era, you know, the wars, the economic crises, you have to say that the media, the corporate press, has done a poor job. You know, they have failed to point out the distortions that have led us into wars. They have missed the fact that we've had an economy built on asset bubbles that was inherently unstable. And if they can't tell us these things, that when it really counts, then you have to say, what can we do to come up with a media that actually does serve the public? And I think the first step to that is thinking in terms of, you know, the that journalism is going to serve the people who run it and who pay for it. And if you get your news paid for largely by corporate advertisers, then you can expect that news to serve the corporate world more than it serves you and your interests.
And the more consolidated the major media get, the less they will give us in terms of real news information. So, my God, I remember when I first I live in a condominium, and when cable first came around, we didn't have it. We've had it for many years now, but when we finally got cable 20 odd years ago, and there was CNN, and then Time Warner bought CNN, and CNN was no that terrific under Ted Turner, but it just went downhill. And it's barely distinguishable from Fox News and all the rest. It's pretty abysmal. I do a little monitoring, but it's very, very painful to see the kind of stuff that they put out.
Yeah, and there's something very locale about cable news.
Locale is a great way to describe it, too.
when it isn't trying to spin you into something ridiculous, it's kind of trying to just keep you distracted enough.
We have to take another break. Let's do that. We'll come back.
Sure.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Jim DeRicus from FAIR. Jim, I know you said you stay on 30 minutes. I always love blocking a full hour for my guests. I despise sound bites. I'm sure you do, too. And, of course, that's the standard fare on the on all of the TV channels. You know, you get 3 minutes, if you're lucky, 4 minutes. Well, who can say anything in 3 or 4 minutes? I can't even clear my throat in 3 or 4 minutes. But you're welcome to stay as long as you want. We'll have a break at the bottom of the hour if you're in the middle of the thought and want to go on a little longer. You absolutely are welcome on this program. But pick up from where you left off, if you remember exactly where you left off. I'll talk about what you see as the future of journalism. You've got a number of articles. I've got the contents of the magazine in front of me, the email that you sent. And I went through a few of the articles, but the future that you see, we both know the future that we both want to see. What do you see ahead? And I'm sure you'll pick up on this topic again.
Well, I think that the future of journalism, the future that we hope for, is going to have a more diverse array of styles and structures of journalism than we have today. I think you'll always have a for-profit media sector, and I think that's healthy. I think it will be smaller, and it will expect smaller profits than it currently does, and it will have more competition than it currently does. And the competition, I think, is going to come from nonprofit journalism, some of which is going to be funded by foundations, and you're beginning to see a little bit of this starting up now. But we hope to see more sort of grassroots journalism that is funded by contributions from the people who read it, because we feel that is really the healthiest and most sustainable kind of journalism. Is journalism that is supported by the readers, by the listeners, by the viewers, and that's when those are the people who are providing the resources. That is when you can most count on the interests of the audience being served. And I think that there is a role for a greater degree of publicly funded media. And I think you have to be very careful to insulate funding from government control. But I think if you look at news outlets like the BBC, I think that they have generally greater independence from their government than the for-profit media, the corporate media do in our country. So I do think that it is possible to have structures unlike the structures that we have with PBS and NPR, which I think are in some ways designed to allow the government to keep public media on a leash.
And
I think you can have
the big corporate funders as well, Jim.
Yeah, and that's not by chance. The media, the government put pressure on PBS in particular to get more corporate funding, because you know there's a recognition that media that is independent of the corporate world is not as easy to control, and that's why you want Archer Daniels Midland or companies like that having their finger on the spigot of PBS resources.
You've done studies showing how skewed their guest lineup is, very heavily on one side, with few alternative voices ever showing up, especially on the biggest stuff, like the run-up to the Iraq War. I'm sure you went through that, but it could be 100-1 against the anti-war people. Well, how does the anti-war message get through when you're outnumbered so extremely like that? That's what they do, the Lira Hour or NPR, and it's very discouraging. Where Pacifica Radio is quite different.
Yeah, Pacifica is overwhelmingly funded by the people who listen to it. They don't accept corporate underwriting, and I think you can very much hear the difference in terms of the range of viewpoints that are allowable on NPR versus the range of viewpoints that you hear on someplace like Democracy Now. It's really like night and day.
Oh, it is like night and day. I have never once been invited on an NPR program, but I've been on several Pacifica stations a few times on wonderful programs on the kind of stuff that I write about and talk about. And I mean, NPR would never allow me to come on here and say stuff like that. But I have free reign to say whatever I want on Pacifica. It's wonderful. And on this program, of course.
Yeah, this is an advertiser supported medium, but
not the big corporations.
Yeah, right. And it shows the role that outlets like this can serve.
Oh, absolutely. Jim, can you stay a little while longer?
Just a little bit.
Okay. Well, you cut it off any point you want. Let's take that break. Come on back, and maybe you can give whatever important thoughts that you haven't covered. And if we can get that in, that would be fine. So we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour with Jim Enriquez from FAIR. Jim, I have to mention FAIR's weekly radio program. My goodness, I couldn't leave that out, even though we're talking about the future of journalism. And the program, of course, is called Counterspin. And listeners to this program can easily access it. Just Google Counterspin, one word, and it'll take you to the site. And you could look at the past programs. You can listen anytime you like from archives. And I see the most recent one, you have had David Swanson on. He's been on this program a couple of times. He'll be back in August talking about healthcare reform. And an earlier program, I see you had Greg Grandin on the Honduran coup, explaining it the way it should be explained, not the way CNN and Fox explains it. Counterspin is a terrific program. And you were on. You were on talking about the future of journalism.
That's right.
Well, again, it's the kind of on-air journalism that we need to get, and extra is the kind of print journalism we need to get. And we need people like you promoting it and what we can do, what all of us can do. For me, I may be on a commercial operation that needs some way to bring in money to keep me and others on the air. I do this as a volunteer, Jim. I'm retired, so I'm in a little different category than people who need to work for a living. But I do this as a volunteer, and if somebody offers me money, I don't want it. And I have been offered a few times, and I simply say donate it to whatever topic that I was dealing with. So I have yet to take one red cent for what I do, which is the way I choose to do it. But again, talk more about the future of journalism, the importance of it as you see it, and where we're going.
Well, that issue of volunteerism in the media is something that I think is going to be something where we'll play an important role in the future of journalism. There is this movement of what's called citizen journalism, where people are contributing to the sort of information flow, not as, you know, paid professional journalists, but as volunteers who are, you know, contributing a diary to a website like Daily Kos, or editing an article that they have some expertise on Wikipedia, or contributing to a local independent radio program, like those on Pacifica radio stations. And there are people who feel like this is the center of the future of journalism. This is where it is headed. And I think that there's something to be said for people who are motivated by a desire to see people better informed, rather than being motivated by a paycheck. On the other hand, I think that you will always need people working full time on these issues, because the complexity of the world that we're looking at does require people who are diving into stories full time, and most people, you know, retirees and the independently wealthy excepted, don't have the time to devote, because they do have to put food on the table. And so I think that while citizen journalism is going to be an important factor in the future, we're going to have to keep thinking about how you pay people as well.
Well, I agree, Jim. I wish more people, having retired from their former working life, like I did. I did 10 years ago at age 65, and I simply did not want to go fishing. I wanted to do something else. I didn't begin writing. I began doing the kind of reading very ferociously that I just never got around to. I didn't have the time to do earlier, and built up a wonderful library that I call my treasure. Just wonderful authors. A fair number of them have been guests on this program. Very noted figures, talking about explaining the things that are so important in depth, the way we need to understand them. And I almost can't explain how I got into this. I call it an accident. It literally was an accident, but it happened. And everything I do, this program and the writing I do, is all volunteer. And I truly love it. I never call it work. It's what I want to do, and it's giving back in one sense, and it's spreading vital information that we all need, because what you're involved in, Jim, and what I see based on the research I do all the time, we really are in a terrible mess, and it's getting worse. It's not getting better. We're losing our liberties. Our economy is in the trash can, and I don't see it getting better. Maybe the newspapers will bounce back, but I've had distinguished people who know the economy better than I do on this program saying we are in for a very extended a downtime economically, and some people express that in much more dire terms, that we could be descending into the depths that people looking back some years could never even imagine could happen. Well, you know, predicting the future is a pretty hazardous thing. but it's very possible based on the things that are going on now, and it could be that this country never will be the same again. So if we want to defend ourselves, then we have to do it ourselves. The people at the top aren't going to defend us. They're looking after the privileged and the society, but the great majority are the rest of us, and we need to protect ourselves. So we need good journalism to do it.
Well, I think that the model that you're demonstrating is quite inspiring. I think that both the way that you've set out to inform yourself and the way that you are sharing what you've learned with the public really is quite admirable.
Well, if I'm lucky, I reach thousands, maybe even on this program, maybe even tens of thousands if enough people spread the word to others. But we don't reach millions, Jim, neither you do nor I do. And we can only hope that the more we do and the more urgency more people feel, the more they'll turn to sources like you and programs on Republic, this one, Pacifica programs. And my mission literally is to get people aroused enough to realize that we really are in a terrible situation. And if we don't do something in our own self-defense, then nobody will do it for us.
Well, the people who speak for power are always going to have the biggest megaphone that they can afford. So if you have any hope for the future, you've got to have faith that in the power of ideas, that a true idea expressed by a small group of people is more powerful than a lie that is broadcast everywhere.
Oh, very definitely. And there were times in the past in this country that the impossible was accomplished. And my number one choice is ending slavery. My goodness, I mean, there was a time in this country many, many generations back that was thought to be impossible, that slavery was the way it was in this country and it was the way it was going to be. But it ended. It sort of took a civil war to do it, but it ended. Maybe a president like Lincoln who didn't free the slaves and really didn't feel very, very close to black people. The Emancipation Proclamation did nothing. But at least he was Lincoln, a lot different than the likes we have today. And slavery ended. Jim Crow was born when slavery ended, and things aren't so terrific today. But we have a new order, and maybe some decades from now we'll have a better order. But we better work for it, Jim. I'm sure you'd agree on that. If we don't work for it, we're never going to get it. It won't be handed to us.
That's absolutely right.
Shall we wrap it up, or do you want to stay on?
I think I've... I've said my piece.
Okay.
I'm a writer more than a talker, really. And people should take a look at what I have to say in the Future Journalism issue of Extra.
Well, I understand that. I never had an interview until May of 2006, Jim, and I almost didn't take it. A couple of friends of mine urged me to do it. I was fearful that I might look foolish. But I did it, and I must say I enjoyed it, and I never looked back. But I understand it's, I think I prefer writing. You can always go back and edit.
Right.
But once the words are out of your mouth, you can't pull them back. It's, oh, let me restate that. Jim, it really was terrific having you on, and I hope we can do this again.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Jim. Well, we have a little time to go, which gives me a chance to do something I don't have opportunity to do all that often, just talk about some other things that concern me greatly. So many. I cover so many different topics in the things that I write about, and I choose them as things go on, and something strikes me as a need to address at any given moment. Sometimes just the title will pop into my mind, and I say I have to put something down on paper to go with that thought, just a theme that strikes me, and I'll put it in the form of a title, and then I want to research it and write some solid material that I can pass on to readers. And again, it can be on any number of topics. One that obsesses me, and we'll have more programming ahead on this, is the so-called swine flu epidemic. It's only one of many. But it's a big one because the machine, the corporate media machine, to scare the public into believing that we have a global pandemic, whereas we do not, we absolutely do not, unless they want to unleash one on us, and that is very much a possibility. They can simply unleash biological weapons into the environment and infect us. But what terrifies me, aside from the possibility of that happening, what terrifies me is they are rushing to market vaccines that are absolutely dangerous, untested, experimental, and must be avoided by people if you value your health. But anybody taking these vaccines, even if they're mandated, which they may be, runs a very serious risk of very serious future health problems, including things that can kill you, absolutely can kill you. I'm working on an article now. I'll probably get it out next week because I have other things that I have to get out too. But it talks about more in-depth specific information on the myths that have been perpetrated about vaccines and the dangers that every single one of them poses. And it won't be me talking. It'll be experts talking, including one person who I quote in the article, who some people consider the foremost authority in the world on the adverse effects of vaccines. All vaccines, not just swine flu. But swine flu is more dangerous than most because, again, they are just rushing this thing through the production process. They'll never vaccinate everybody in the world, but we're talking about getting many hundreds of millions of people vaccinated. And everybody who lets that needle go into their arm will risk their health. It may kill them. There's an awfully strong possibility it'll cause what I call very annoying to life-threatening future health problems. Well, I absolutely will not take this vaccine. I was born before mass immunizations became prominent, but I know I was vaccinated for smallpox. I was born in the mid-1930s. I know I was vaccinated for smallpox. I don't know when, but I've got the smallpox mark on my body that signifies I was vaccinated. I believe also for tetanus and diphtheria, those things. I only took one other vaccination in my life, and I regret taking it, but so far I've been lucky. Polio vaccine in the early 1960s, came out in the mid-1950s. Polio vaccine is extremely dangerous. Well, again, they're all dangerous. But before the age of mass immunizations, countries or communities that practiced sound diet and hygiene practices were far healthier than societies in the age of mass immunizations who relied on that, and incidences of all sorts of diseases and illnesses were much, much higher in those communities, in those societies. And again, I'm putting together an article on this, and the conclusion is very simple. Good lifestyle will protect you. Vaccines will harm you, and of course, bad lifestyles will harm you. It's so easy to have a good lifestyle, unless you're impoverished and live in a place where you're simply unable to do it, then it's beyond your control. But for people, certainly in the West, people in America, most people, to at least some degree, you can have a healthy lifestyle, and it doesn't mean loading up on expensive foods. Some of the best foods are not all that expensive, like whole grains that anybody can buy, certainly in most U.S. cities. You can buy them. They're inexpensive. And my goodness, you can get enough whole grains to serve as the centerpiece of many meals compared to the typical meat and potatoes diet that most people have. Well, I've been a vegetarian for a long time. I'd never go back to do it the other way. But you don't have to be a vegetarian to have a healthy diet. But these vaccines are absolutely criminal to be rushing the market. The market potential for these drug companies is far greater than I thought. Michelle Chostadovsky's article he put up over the weekend, where he talks about militarizing the country. He had a number that surprised me. I didn't realize it was so big. $400 billion globally potential. depends on how many vaccines these drug companies sell. Well, France, I understand, has ordered 90 million vaccines for swine flu. Money has been funded through the Congress in the U.S. for swine flu, and there'll be more where that's coming from. And, of course, a lot of people will just go out and get it on their own. And the figure that Michelle used in his article was $10 a shot. Well, most people can afford $10 a shot. But I have never taken a flu shot in flu season. I never would. I think that's a worthless exercise. We're not talking about a vaccine now. We're just talking about a flu shot against whatever the prevalent strain would be. I don't think it's a vaccine. I may be wrong. But it's an annual shot against whatever the most prevalent strain of flu is thought to be coming in. But there are many strains of flu. So maybe another one will come in. So you could get a flu shot. And maybe another one will come in, or maybe you travel to another city and you pick up the flu virus, which doesn't happen to be the one you took a shot for. So I've always thought that taking flu shots are a no-win situation, and maybe you're injecting something toxic into your system that you're better off without. So my advice is, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a scientist, but my advice is stay away from the stuff. Absolutely stay away from the swine flu vaccine. There simply is no question that it is extremely dangerous, and you don't have to be a scientist or a doctor to know that. Let's take that final break, and I'll come back with some final thoughts. All mine, my goodness, a bonus for me today. We'll be right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. I'm on solo for the rest of the hour. Let me just tell you about the rest of the week. Tomorrow we'll have on Webster Tarpley. Webster does an awful lot of good economic writing. He has a prescription for fixing the California economic crisis. We'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about there's a few things on his mind. We'll try to get in as much as we can. We'll try to get in also some information on his newest book, which I have in my hand. Oh, it's a big book, and it's titled "Surviving the Cataclysm: Your Guide to the Greatest Financial Crisis in Human History." I certainly agree with that. Financial/economic/systemic. It is a monster. And I absolutely believe it's getting worse. I suspect that Webster feels the same way. Thursday and Friday, Ellen Brown will be back. Ellen and I have always talked about her economic/financial writing when she comes on. We'll do that on Thursday. And she emailed me before the program began that she would be going on a conference call that may be taking place right now. Her and Michael Hudson, who's been on this program, and maybe some others with California legislators or their aides, talking about what they really should be doing to fix their economy, not the outrageous bill that they agreed to. And I don't know whether it's official yet. But they want to take a bad situation and absolutely wreck the state by making it worse. In other words, make people suffer when there are much, much more effective ways to deal with their situation. And Ellen's written about it. So you get Ellen Brown and Michael Hudson on with those people. I don't know whether they'll listen to them or not, but they certainly have superb ideas on how California and every other state ought to be addressing the problem. On Friday, most people may not know that Ellen has also written a number of books, I think about 10 or 12 books, on natural healing, natural remedies. And again, going back to the swine flu situation and the vaccine, we'll address that topic on Friday. So two separate topics with Ellen on Thursday and Friday. And it's all vital stuff. The economy, of course, is so important because what's happening. And the major media portrays that the worst is over. Some people have said the recession is over. It's onward and upward from here. Well, it's not over. We may be in a twilight zone right now where they can manipulate data to make things look better than it really is. I get some wonderful material that comes to me from economists who tell the truth in emails. One comes every single day, just reinterpreting the data much differently from the way the major media portrays it to people. And things just not as rosy as they want it to make people believe. So we'll see. There are a lot of months ahead. The Obama program to address the situation certainly is not designed to fix it. So at some point or other, whatever is going on now will start erupting again and people will feel it more. And I think if we brought on people who were losing their homes and jobs and asked them what they thought of the economy, I would suspect that they would have a different view from the dominant one that gets portrayed in the major media. But another very interesting thing is that Obama's approval rating has been steadily going down. I think he's around 50% or maybe a little bit below that right now, depending on what poll you see. But I think he is beginning to sink. And my feeling is, given the way things are going, he may sink to the sub. He may get as low as George Bush before it's over, because he certainly isn't doing anything to relieve the problems that people are facing. I hear that music. That means time is up. So let me just welcome you back tomorrow with Webster Topley. We'll talk about the economy. Key topic. Please join us then, and then again the rest of the week and next week.